Building Pashas Key Safety. And we had seen that the Torah, we had seen the mitzvahs of the Pasha thus far, the mitzvah of going out to war, the mitzvah of Ben Sora Mora, two wives, son you like more, a wife you like more, a wife you like less. And we had ended with building a new house, that you do make a bracha. I don't remember who asked that, you do make a bracha when you build the post, when you build the ma'akev, so people don't fence, so you don't fall off the roof. We had discussed that you shouldn't leave things that are a danger in your home. And then we started the story of Motzi Shemra. The classical case of Motzi Shemra is a guy gets married, and he comes after the wedding, and he says he wasn't a virgin. And then he says, you know, I heard people talking, and between the time we were engaged, which today our engagement doesn't mean much, but biblically there were two stages to a wedding, Kiddushin and Nisuin. They would first, he would give her some form of money, but we do under the chuppah, we do both. There are two stages to marriage, Kiddushin and Nisuin. So today we do them both together. Once upon a time there was a year in between, where the first stage is he gives her something of value, and he says, now you're set aside to me, and now we are bound. And from that second on, she is considered a married woman for all intents and purposes. They may not live together as husband and wife until they finish the marriage with the second stage, with the contract, and doing Nisuin is taking her into his home, whatever. However we consummate, we end the marriage. But the first stage is legally binding. She is biblically his wife. And he has obligations to her, she has obligations to him. So the first stage is Kiddushin. That's what we do under the chuppah, that he gives her the ring. That's stage number one. He gives her something of value, or he could write on a contract, now we are married. Or they could, the third way a couple could get married is they take witnesses and they say we're going into the bedroom now, and this is a way of doing marriage. If someone does that, the court will flog him. It's considered improper. But biblically, he could do that. He could have witnesses of yichud. When a husband and kala go into the cheder yichud, they go into the yichud room. What's really happening is nothing. But the idea is that the witnesses say, we know they were alone. Something could have happened. Not that something does happen, unless you live in England. In England, the way they do marriages is they do the kiddushin, they do the chuppah, and then the couple goes to their hotel room and everyone else goes home, and then that night they get together for the dance. And by that night, theoretically something is supposed to happen. That's the only place I know of that, that's the way it works. Now, historically, in the time of the Tanakh, this wasn't the way it worked. So first you'd have kiddushin, he'd give her something of value, and then he'd say, okay, a year from now we're getting married. She'd get ready, he'd get ready, he has to build the house, he has to have parnas, everything's ready. She prepares her dowry, whatever she's going to bring into the marriage, and then they meet and they make a wedding. Now, you should know that weddings used to be, she left her family, that's it, she's now part of his town, and that's part of the idea of the Afros, that we celebrate the Shabbos, the last Shabbos, the last Shabbos that she has on the last Shabbos by him, he's going to take her and he's, she's coming to his town. And then they come, the families get together. People used to be so poor that at a wedding, everyone used to bring a dish. That was how they made weddings. That's why weddings were very often done on Fridays. Throughout Europe, weddings were done on Fridays, because everyone baked for Shabbos, and then they'd have a communal Shabbos meal, everyone was together. Sometimes they ran into trouble that they didn't finish signing the ksuba and it was Shabbos, and everyone's coming to celebrate and there's no wedding because they didn't finish the procedure. This happened a lot. You see, the Mishnah Berurah says that they'd come to the wedding and all the women would suddenly remember 10 minutes after sunset, we didn't light candles. So Mishnah Berurah says it's not right that they're all sending their maids, you go light candles for us. You should have lit candles on time, you didn't light candles. But this happened all the time, that they get too late at the wedding or they wouldn't light Shabbos candles. But everyone would bring a dish and they'd sit down for the wedding meal. Now, if we go back a few thousand years before the time of the Mishnah, going back to the period of the first temple, so then it was a custom which no one discusses. It's hush-hush. So I'm going to tell you, but you should know that if you're going to mention it, the Shabbos table, so first of all, it's improper. These things we could discuss in the classroom, but if you're sitting with a family for a Shabbos meal, these aren't the things you should be discussing. It's not right. The hostess, the kids. And that's another thing we'll see in our parasha. The Torah tells us to be careful to speak in a proper language, not to use foul words or speak about improper things. But these are mitzvahs in the Torah, these are laws in the Torah, and we have to learn them, so we're learning them. But that doesn't mean we have to sit at a Shabbos table where there might be the hostess or their daughter or someone else. It's not comfortable for them to discuss it. But the ancient custom that was from the time of Bereishis through the time basically since the Second Temple, and maybe even through the beginning of the Second Temple, was that they had kiddushin, And a year later, they met and they made the marriage ceremony. And at the marriage ceremony, the couple was finished. They would do the nisuin. He'd take her into his house, however, whatever the last stage of marriage is. And then they'd go either into his house or into a private room, and there were witnesses standing outside. And inside that room, they'd have a white blanket. And when they left the room, the witnesses would have to walk into the room and take out the blanket with the stain of blood. And when a woman's a virgin, so theoretically there should be blood there. And that was testimony that she was a virgin. And that's why the Torah discusses the situation where he claims, that's what the parsha were standing at. He claims, I married her, she wasn't a virgin, she tricked me. And part of the procedure is that her parents come to court and they bring that blanket and they say, what's he talking about? So you'll say, wait a second, they could have cut a chicken and put chicken blood on that blanket. What does that prove? So we'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
Also, what if she broke her hymen years before? So she
should have told him. A woman who lost her hymen gets a lesser ksuba. A woman ordinarily, if she's a virgin, gets 200. If she's not a virgin,
maybe
she gets
broken. Right.
So that's a discussion. That's our two opinions in the Mishnah, whether she loses it for that or not. But probably she should have told him. I mean, he thinks one thing is the case and something else is the case. What? Yeah.
Learned somewhere. Yes. Because there's a potential that she might have been raped, that it wasn't really a practical. Because then, therefore, she's no longer a virgin. Therefore, not. And the law would only be applied to Kohanim who weren't allowed. Weren't allowed to. Even if she were raped, she was going to be allowed to marry her.
So that's, you're bringing in a lot of details. What you're saying is true in certain circumstances. So the first 2-3 deaths in the Sefer Ksuvos, but it involves a lot of details which I don't think should go into now. Right now, I want to get the basic picture of what marriage is. But what is the case of Motzi Shemra? What's going on here? So the guy's coming into court and he's saying, we got married. Usually got married on a night where the next morning you show up at court if there's an issue, and he says she wasn't a virgin, she tricked me, and now I'm hearing people talking and I hear that something went on between the time that we got engaged and the time we were married. Now legally, once she's engaged, not what we call engagement today, but the ring that they give men today, when you give a ring, it's just a sign, hey, we like to call ourselves engaged, but halachically there's nothing binding. You just give her a gift, you give her a ring. What we call engagement today isn't real engagement. What was engagement once was you gave her a ring with witnesses and you made sheva brachos. Halakhically you did kiddushin. So he says, I'm going to bring witnesses that during the period between the engagement and the marriage, she went with someone else. So now, two things can happen. One thing that can happen are her parents can come and say, this is ridiculous. Here are our witnesses, here's the blanket that was there, it's a lie. And then he gets punished. And that's called the Motzi Shemra. That's the person who gives a bad name to someone. So we know you're not allowed to say Lashon Hara. I'm not allowed to say about someone something that might inadvertently somewhere cause him damage, something that he might feel bad about or that people see badly. Say about a person, I don't know, what's a good example of Lashon Hara? You say, he cheated on his taxes. Or you could say a different type of Lashon Hara. I don't want to tell you what he did. I didn't say anything. Yeah, that's a slimy way of saying Lashon Hara. Him. Sometimes you could just even be quiet. Sometimes they call you about a shidduch, call you about your friend. Could you tell us about this guy? I want to date him. What can you say about him? I don't know. I don't know. Ask someone else. What do you mean you don't know? You're with him for 3 years. You don't know? There are things that you could say that you're inadvertently saying Lashon Hara. And then there could be Motzi Shemra. Motzi Shemra is that what this guy did. It's not true. He's just spreading a lie. A guy wants to go into business with someone else, and so someone else says, I don't know what he did in his last business transaction. On the other hand, sometimes you have to tell a person. I had a guy once in 8th grade. I taught 8th grade, and I had a guy who used to shoplift. The candy store owner came to me once and said, talk to the kids. We're catching shoplifting. Next time I'm calling the cops. And I saw that the kid was like shoplifting. So then someone once called me for a reference, a jeweler who was looking to work as the cashier. So what was I supposed to say? I mean, this guy can handle thousands of dollars. I can't let him fall. So I had to tell him. But even then, you have to know all the halachas, how you tell a person. But over here, we have one of the examples of Lashon Hara, and that's the classical case of Motzi Shemra, one who gives a bad name is this. And then there are other cases, obviously, you could extrapolate. Now, if what he said is true, if you do have witnesses, so then she did something which is deserving of the death penalty. We have witnesses, we have warning, etc. Sure.
So, is the Chazan obligated to say something if he doesn't keep well?
That's a good question.
If he is obligated,
So if it's true, so we have to cover a few things here. I don't want to run into halacha now, so I'm just going to present a few ideas. And when a person is learning for marriage, these are one of the things that should be covered. I'm not speaking halacha now, but I want you to recognize a few concepts that exist. What's halacha and what isn't halacha, I don't want to touch now. The whole issue over here is that there was a period between the engagement and the marriage. Meaning, if we do marriage like we do marriage today, where the engagement and marriage all happen at the same place, so nothing could have happened between engagement and marriage. You were standing right next to you under the chuppah. The maximum that could have happened, is before you got engaged. Then the maximum claim that a husband could have is not like this claim where he's claiming she did something that she's deserved as death penalty and I'm not allowed to continue living with her as my wife. If she did something to engagement and marriage, they're not allowed to continue living together as husband and wife. But what's the maximum claim that a guy could say? Well, she wasn't a virgin. So firstly, if you're dating a balas tshuva or a gioris, so then you have to assume she's not a virgin. If you don't, you're foolish. And the same thing is true when someone's dating a balas tshuva. That's basically understood that he's not going to be a virgin. And same thing again. If that is not the case, then you might want to find a way of giving her that message. It's a plus.
So the common concept is really not supposed to be dating a balas tshuva at all, even if she actually never...
That's a good question. A gioris, a kohen, is not allowed to marry. A balas tshuva, you should ask your local Orthodox family. A gioris is forbidden. A balas tshuva depends on many factors. Well, that's true. The Kohen has to ask his rabbi. There are very unfortunate cases that happened. There was a Baal Tshuva and a Baalas Tshuva that were engaged, and then before the marriage, he went to Europe, and she was a Gioris. He was a Baal Tshuva. Before the marriage, he went to Europe and he visited the graves of his fathers, and he came upon a grave of his grandfather, and he saw the hands like this. So he comes back home to his rabbi and he says, there's this funny thing on all the graves of the family. Everyone has their hands like this. What's going on? So he tells him, are you sure? And they verified, and the guy was a coin. They had to break, they couldn't get married. It's a tragedy. We try to find any leniency, but we try not to get into the problem. That's why I always ask, before I offer a balas tshuva, when I do a shidduch, balas tshuva, gioris, first I ask if the guy's a coin. If he's a coin, so then, if she's a balas tshuva, it depends on the circumstance. If she's a gioris, then they can't get married. They shouldn't get married. What?
No.
I had a girl tell me that once. And a girl was a gioris. She said, I have a friend who's a gioris, and she dated a kohen. And he said, I love her so much, I'm willing to forgo it, so my kids won't be good kohanim. That's a mistake. Every day he's with her is a transgression. That's not right. He could not say that. So I didn't want to correct her. She was a gioris. Why should I insult her? She knew that she wasn't supposed to do it herself. Okay, well, it wasn't practical. It had no practical application, so why should I argue with him? Yeah?
There was a story about some of the guys of the cousin who wanted to be married at a divorce, and he chopped up his little son, and he was no longer a cousin.
I don't know. What? What? How old was she when they did you?
No.
She wasn't born yet? Then there's no problem. The problem is if she was a little kid, we say the basis for a Kohen having a problem marrying a Biyoris is that we say among the non-Jews you can't trust them that she was kept pure. And we say from age 3 and up, a girl is physically fit, that if a man was with her, we say that it's not like sticking a finger into her eye, but rather that's considered that she had relations with a man. Under the age of 3, we say two things. A, we say that that's not considered anything. It's considered like hurting a person, not considered human relations. And there's another thing which doesn't have relevance to here, but used to be the case. I don't know if it's still the case medically, but Chazal say that in their times, if a girl under the age of 3 lost her hymen, it came dead. Under the age of 3, it came dead. So much so that the Yerushalmi says a fascinating thing. Yerushalmi says that this goes by the Jewish calendar. I guess they checked this out. They verified it. So let's say a girl was born in the month of Nisan. Her birthday is the first day of the month of Nisan. So a year later, the month of Nisan, she's 1 year old. Another year later, she's 2 year old. Now, the next year comes around, and we're holding the month of Adar. In 30 days, she's about to become 3. Meaning if she sits on the sliding pond and she loses it, so today it'll still come back. That's what the Gemara says. And then the courts decide, we just did all the calculations, we're making it a leap year. So Nisan's going to be 1 month off, a month later. But the Gemara says, and I guess they verified this, that she has 1 more month where it'll come back. If the court would not have made it a leap year, it wouldn't have come back. If they made it a leap year, it does. How does that work? Don't ask me. I don't know. But that's what the Gemara says. We have a few examples in the Gemara of things where nature seems to be under their control. Why that works, I don't know. Just saying, yeah?
Is it allowed that a bat Kohen is marrying
a bat Kohen to marry a girl? Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, that's okay. Again, this isn't allowed. I'm not looking in. If I'm not mistaken, that's okay, yeah. Before, if it's relevant, I'll ask if someone comes in and I could look it up, make sure I'm remembering correctly. But I mean, it's 10 o'clock on my watch, too. No, okay, yeah.
They lost it 3 year old, because I know there are certain other ones, but didn't they? First, you are not allowed to date the little girl. Yeah, at first, things like this, which is surprising. Oh, this idea of the 3 years, and you know, people will mature much quicker, 100 years ago.
That's true, but there are a few darim in halacha. We're discussing one point. There are other points in halacha. We say that there's an age where we consider it normal that people will be attracted to her, and there's an age where it's not normal. There's an age where we're concerned something's going to happen. There's an age where we aren't concerned something will happen. And if we're mentioning this now, so A, we will deal with it. We will have a class on the laws of Yibut, God willing. There's one on the web if you want to listen to it from last year, but we're going to have it again soon. I don't know, this semester or next semester, as soon as we can, we'll get to it. But I will tell you that, aside from halacha, when you're a parent, you have to be intelligent. And if you're having weirdos over, so it's very nice you'd have weirdos over, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to leave your kids with them. So I can tell you that between me and my wife, we are very careful when we leave the kids with whom, and especially we have a lot of guests sleeping over very often. That's very nice. You don't have to be a fool. It's very nice to be nice to people, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be smart. Before you ask me halacha, you should also know to be practical. Now we'll also learn halacha. Mitzvah, we will have a class on that. Not just because you want to be nice to a person doesn't mean that's right to leave your kids there. Yeah, you shouldn't trust anyone with your kids. In general, I think that people feel like part of being a Jew is to be foolish. It's not so. You're not more firm because you're foolish. You're just foolish if you're foolish. Part of being firm is being a nice person. Doesn't mean that you have to be. We said last week, we didn't get it on the recording. Last week's parsha said, "Tamim tiyem Hashem lokecha." You should be tamim. Should be a simple, humble, modest, whole person. With who? With your Creator, not with your fellow man. Your fellow man, you have to be sharp. You have to be vivid. You have to know what's going on. You're not supposed to be dupe. Yeah, see. Direct, yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Only for
Batsim, for Batsim? No, it's for Batsim, the door of the Kohen. Was there another question? Okay.
You don't understand.
What?
You don't understand.
the laws of a bat kohen, if she, while she is halachically engaged after the kiddushin, if she goes with another man, then her death penalty is more severe than the death penalty of a girl who is not the daughter of a kohen. Okay. The Torah says, what happens if a person grabs a girl out in the field? So, we always have a choice what we should focus on in life. So I choose to focus on you guys. You're the majority, he's the minority. sorry, Michal, it's an important minority, but still a minority. The Torah tells us that if a girl is out in the field and she's caught by a man and he forces her to have relations with him, so then she doesn't get punished. What could she do? She yelled and no one was there to save her. So we derive from this many, many laws. We derive from this, firstly, the halacha says there was no one there to save her. What if there is someone there to save her? So the halacha says he has to save her. He has to save her, firstly, by trying to get the guy off. If he can't get the guy off, then he should maim the guy. If he can't maim the guy, he should kill the guy. So in halacha, we treat rape as critical as murder. We derive the halacha that says that if one person is chasing someone else to kill him, that you may kill that person. So you say, he's about to kill him. The halacha says, yeah. If you could, chop off his leg. If you could, take out his eyes. If you can't do that, kill him. That's the halacha. If Reuven is chasing Shimon to kill him, so anyone else should kill Reuven. Or stop Reuven any way he could. But where do we know this from? We know this from this case. Because the Torah says, because don't punish the girl, what did she do wrong? It's like someone who came to murder someone else. So too, she had no choice. So we say, what's the Torah comparing the two? The Torah is teaching us that in a case of murder, just like this girl, you're supposed to save her any way you could, even if it means you have to murder the person. So too, from the girl, we derive that in a case of murder, you save the person. And this is the concept of Rodef. The concept of Rodef is that if someone is chasing someone else to kill him, so then we are permitted to kill the person who's chasing him. Now, this has applications. I'll get to it in just a second. This has applications. Let's say a woman is pregnant, and the doctors say that the child is endangering her life, and the child isn't born yet. So halakhically, there are stages to when we say that a fetus is alive. 40 days after conception is one level of life. 3 months is another level of life. And the final level of life is when the baby sticks out his head and wails, when we hear his voice, when his head is out. There are different stages to life. But complete life, we don't consider it a whole life until his head is out. Now, that doesn't mean we allow abortion. I didn't say that. Ordinarily, you're not allowed to abort. But what happens if the doctors say the woman's going to die? We had now, this week, a woman was pregnant, and the doctors didn't realize how much the baby had grown. The baby was over 4 kilos, which is, he was over 9 pounds. Wow. And when it came time to take him out, they thought they're going to have to cut her all up to get the baby out. Today, a woman lived. But those of you who read Shakespeare know that in ancient times, Caesar, right? Caesar was taken from his mother, and she died when he was born, right? That's the whole story, that he's going to be killed by someone who's not born from a woman. Caesar wasn't born from a woman. That was Macbeth, right, yeah. Right, but because mother was dead when he was born, and that's why it's called the Caesarian, because we give Yichus to Caesar, goes back to Caesar. So in ancient times, a woman could not live if you'd cut her up to take out the baby. They didn't know how to do it. Today, we do it every day. So in ancient times, the halacha said, if the baby's endangering the mother, and he hasn't yet stuck out his head, so you cut up the baby and take him out by parts, so as not to endanger the mother. That baby we treat as a hodesh. That baby is chasing the mother's life. He's trying to kill her. And that baby is not yet fully alive. On the one hand, an abortion is prohibited. But now we have a situation where the baby has entered the scene and he's endangering her life. She's not doing anything to him. He's endangering her life. So then we apply this halacha. Again, where is this halacha derived from? From the story of the guy who's chasing the girl, that we say you can kill the guy who's trying to take the girl forcibly. So you can kill the fetus. Assuming he didn't stick his head out. Once his head is out, once we've heard him, and he's alive, so then we let him fight it out. Whoever lives between the two, we say we can't intervene. He's alive and she's alive. Before he sticks his head out, we say, now he's chasing her and he's not yet fully alive. Yeah?
What happens if the 50-50 cool? You want to definitely
die? So, unfortunately, these are questions that come up all the time. It depends on the circumstance. There are cases where the rabbis will argue with the doctors. where the rabbis will say this is a greater danger or a lesser danger. Not always do we go by what the doctors say, but we first hear what they say, and usually we'll take at least the second opinion. In halacha, the concept of second opinion shows up in halacha, and the Gemara discusses on Yom Kippur, when you tell a woman to break her fast, so the halacha says you get a second opinion, you take two doctors. Just like, you remind me your name, I'm trying to get the name. Baruch, yeah.
The question was, if you are facing your life in danger, and often the person is wanting to make it good, you won't.
So, that's a question which we might deal with in Bereshit a little bit. That's a discussion, the concept in halacha is called safek sakana. Do I have to put myself in a situation where I will be safek, maybe in danger, in order to save other people? The classical example of that is Yosef. His brothers go out to the city of Shechem, and his father feels like his brothers are in danger. So he tells Yosef, go check how they're doing. I don't want them in Shechem. So Yosef is going to put himself in a questionable situation of danger to save his brothers from their danger. Can you do that? Can you go save someone from a building that's falling down, the World Trade Center? Should you go in to save people when you're maybe endangering your own life? That's a big question. The question is also, what must you do and what may you do? There are going to be a few answers there. So that's a whole class in and of itself. So, yeah?
If someone is trying to murder somebody, both people are alive at the time. So why, if the baby gets its head out and becomes alive, is no longer considered related?
Good question. Good question. Why is the baby not a rodent once he sticks his head out? I don't remember.
But how can anybody be a rodent if even a rodent is something that they're trying to kill them?
Okay, you added the word deliberately. I didn't say that. When you add that word to the definition of rodent, when you add the intent, so then you have a question. You're assuming that a rodent is someone who is deliberately going to do it. Let's take a different case. They take a fat man and they put a baby under a window and they push the fat man out the window. The fat man's going to fall on the baby. Is that fat man a rodent or is he not a rodent? Okay, but am I allowed to stick the knife underneath to ensure that he doesn't fall on the baby? Meaning, you're right, they pushed him, very good, but right now he's about to kill the baby. So all this is
just... deliberate?
He's not deliberate, what can he do? He's being thrown off out of the window. So you're assuming, by defining a rodent as something that's deliberate, that he's not a rodent. I'm not sure that's the case. That's something, the Gemara discusses that, but from the case of the baby, is a good proof that it doesn't seem to have to do with his intent. The fact of the matter is, he's about to kill someone. You're right that there are aspects where it seems more logical to say that he's only rodent if he has intent. Because otherwise you say, why is this life more important than that life? I mean, there are a few concepts in these halachas. One of the concepts is called Maichazit de Damach Samik Fe. Maichazit, what did you see? The Damach, that your blood, Samik, is red, Fe more. Why do you think your blood is more red than his blood? So if they have a question of spilling your blood or his blood, so you're chasing him to kill it. So you say, in this case, it's not his fault. So there, that aspect might come into play. And there are a few aspects, a few logical approaches to why we kill the person who's trying to kill someone else. So far, we haven't applied logic. We derived it from the Torah. We didn't say that the Torah gives us a logical reason. The Torah gives us a law. There are also logical reasons behind it, and that's where what you're saying would come into play also. Yeah?
What in the case of a woman or a girl was raped and becomes pregnant of the rape, and she doesn't feel that she is proper to become mother of this child?
So let's give it up for adoption. Other people will raise it. This happens all the time. I get this question all the time. So I'll tell you that the first thing is, I don't believe them when they say it's rape. When they get pregnant, then it's always rape. I get this question, I think, once every few months. Someone calls up, I know this girl, she's pregnant, she wants to know if she could abort, it was rape. So I say, yeah, let's get together as a social worker, let's sit down, let's talk about it, let's figure out what we could do. You have to move quickly, because if you get it before the 40 days, there are more leniencies than after the 40 days. But 99% of the times, they don't know they're pregnant until after the 40 days. How do you derive what?
How do you derive that they're alive?
that they're lying? So far, I've been right.
You've been right?
Yeah.
How do you know you've been right?
What?
How do you know you've been right?
That would involve a lot of details which I don't want to mention.
Wow.
What difference does it make? It's when it comes up. So you'll
stories
send them to an organization called
the
Stories
don't add up.
What?
The stories don't add up.
The stories
yeah,
don't
yeah,
add up.
That's how you know they're not
only the stories don't add up. If the guy was her boyfriend, is her boyfriend, then this isn't the first time. There are a thousand ways you know that it's. There are a lot of things that you see at the end of the day that no one wants to say they want to abort a baby. They have to give some legitimacy. They did. Okay. I'm not saying that rape doesn't happen. It happens. It happens every day, unfortunately. I'm just saying that usually when they come with the question and they say it was rape, you just have to wonder if it really was or wasn't. Before you come and assume that that's true, and now well, what do you say about abortion? So I say, first of all, let's just be clear that who knows if it's true. And then even if it is true, who said you're allowed to kill a baby just because she doesn't want it? So maybe there are other ways of dealing with it. The baby is still, why kill a living creature? So give it up for adoption. That's what many people do. Non-Jews also. A lot of the kids that go to adoption are people who say, I can't handle a baby. I won't be a good parent. And it's for the baby's sake, not because they want to get rid of the baby. There are many stories that way. Yeah. No? Yeah.
Also, I wonder if, this is like a 16 or 17-year-old girl, I mean, it'll be an absolute shame-burning. She's like still in school, and like if she has to be pregnant. Would there be any more leniency of saying a case like that? I wonder.
Is that a reason to take a human life?
There are
different states in the United States where they have special institutions from women who unfortunately had this happen to them, and the women could go there, and they take a year of vacation. And they get a job out in Hawaii or California or Florida. There are a few places that help these girls out, and then no one has to know about it. They could have the baby, and someone else to bring them up. But these are all practical questions. If you guys are interested, we'll deal with them. But I don't know. The Torah says the girl has not done a sin that is deserving of death. So you can't punish her. From here we notice the Torah says she hasn't done a sin that is deserving of death, but you can't say she's 100% clean. People have to be careful where they go also. And this is true for boys and girls. I tell parents, and parents prefer to be innocent again and foolish and think that they're being thrown by it and innocent. But I've said this many times. You have young boys, it's improper to send them through the woods to go to a swimming pool. So you'll say, but what do I have to worry about? Someone read a newspaper, you know what you have to worry about. You send kids to go swimming, send someone with them. You send kids to mikveh, send someone with them. You're sending a 7-year-old boy or a 9-year-old boy, it's no different than sending a girl, just like the Torah says that the girl didn't do a sin that's deserving of death. But she did do something improper. Why is she walking out in the middle of the field all alone and she put herself in a vulnerable situation? She should have been more careful. So we're not saying it's her fault, but we are saying that a person should be careful. Why does that bother you?
Why should she be responsible for someone else raping her? Why should she?
We didn't say she was responsible.
Why should she have to worry that wherever she goes, someone should.
Let's analyze it for a second. I once sat on a plane, and the guy sitting in the seat next to me was a big businessman here in Israel. And he asked me if there's equality in Judaism. So I told him that it depends how you define equality. If you define equality, giving a driver's license to a blind man, because equality, everyone should have the right to drive on the road, so then no, we don't believe that that's equality. Wait, it's not fair you should get upset. Wait, you didn't hear me out. The the question is, when you expect fair treatment for everyone, what does that mean? What does it mean? Does it mean that I'm allowed to go on the street and you shouldn't beat me up? Yeah, means I should be allowed to go on the street and you shouldn't beat me up. Does it mean that if I'll walk in the street and I'll have a big sign on my chest that says, King David is a fool, so then King David might kill me? Yeah, King David might kill me. So, I'm not allowed to do what I want? No, the answer is you're not allowed to do what you want. There are certain obligations that every person has. And there are certain things that if you, I think it was Abraham Lincoln that said, freedom of speech doesn't entitle you to walk into the theater and yell fire.
Yeah.
Right? Lincoln said it? So everyone knows that there are certain logical limitations that apply in this world. And freedom doesn't mean the freedom to do anything I want. The freedom means to do anything that's logical and fair to do in the society we live in. Still here, we're in agreement, right? Okay. Right. I want to make sure we're together. One step at a time. Wait. If we live in a city where you have Nazis walking around and they say every Jew should walk with a yellow star, so would you say, what does the halacha tell me I have to do? I tell you, the halacha says walk out with a yellow star. Why endanger your life over such a foolish thing? They want you with a yellow star, wear a yellow star. And you'll say, what, Allah is telling me what to do? I want to dress how I want. Why should I have to wear the yellow star? And the answer is going to be that in the present situation, in the way that the place and the area, the way things are now, the way things run, you have to be careful. Now, we have to discern between the ideal and the practical. In the ideal state, you're right. What does a girl have to worry about? Why should anything happen? But we also have to be practical. And practically, we know that things do happen. Practically, even today, unfortunately, there isn't a girl that hasn't been abused to an extent. Now, that depends on how you define the word abuse. But you'll be surprised at what's going on the average bus or subway, anywhere. In Israel, in the United States, anywhere. Speak to girls, find out what's going on. I think that any time you touch a person and he doesn't want to be touched, that's a certain element of abuse. Now, even? Assume you were careful enough. I don't think accidents are fair when a person isn't careful enough. Meaning, there are accidents and there are accidents. When the halacha tells us certain things, so the halacha assumes that we're living in a certain society. And the halacha takes into account that people are not always going to behave the way they should. So now the question is, there are halachas where we say, can a couple have a wedding and the women will dance? Yeah, they can dance. Should they have a mechitza there? Some say they have to have a mechitza there. Some say they don't have to have a mechitza there. So you'll say, but if there's no mechitza, the women are dancing, so the men are going to see things that aren't proper. So those opinions that say they don't have to have a mechitza say, well, men, mind your own business. You're not supposed to be living there. That's their problem. It's not the women's problem. Does that mean that a woman could walk out dressed immodestly? No. There are things that we say are the woman's obligation. The woman's obligation is to be dressed modestly. The woman's obligation is not to be dressed in a way that's immodest. So each one has his obligations. But when it comes to the practical applications of what may happen out in the field, so the practical applications are that these things are happening every day. The practical applications are that Allah says that if you have a boy who wants to babysit, so then we say, you're 18, there's going to be a 12-year-old girl in the house, you can't babysit there alone. You'll say, why? What's going to happen? And we'll say, well, things happen. practically, it's what happens. I mean, everyone here has all these examples about girls getting pregnant at young ages. So obviously these things are happening. The halacha is very, very practical and very realistic. And realistically, there are things going on out there. Now for a person to turn a blind eye and say, I can do whatever I want, I'm okay. So in halacha we say, no, there's a division of responsibility. Men are responsible to do what they're supposed to do. The courts are responsible to put policemen out to enforce things. But women also have a certain responsibility when it comes to where they're going to allow themselves to be caught.
For example, do I think that women should walk around with whippery whistles just in case? I think that if they feel that that's very comfortable, that makes them comfortable, I think that that's absolutely no problem. That if they want to walk around with mace in their bag, that's fine. That's great also. I think it can be great for them. But it shouldn't be that if they don't, that they are doing something wrong.
That's when you're applying practical applications. The halacha says there's a division of responsibilities. She has a responsibility not to put herself in that situation. He has a responsibility not to do it. We'll kill him if he doesn't do it. We're not killing her. If he tries to do it, we will kill him. We're not saying she's the one at fault. But we are saying that there is an element where she should not put herself in that situation. It's practical. I don't think that's... It's not... No, we're saying that the halacha is saying that what's proper for a girl is not to allow herself to get in that situation. When we were engaged, so we were considering opening a certain business, and my wife was going to run the business. So there was a guy who we had to meet with. We never met the guy. We called him on the phone, and he called us, and my wife was going to go meet him. It was a certain machine we were going to distribute. So we were engaged. We weren't even married then. So I told my wife, look, you don't know who the guy is. He's inviting you theoretically to his office, but you can't go alone. We don't know if he's a religious person, if there is, if it isn't, but what's going on there? You can't go alone. So I went with her, even though really she was the one running the show. I didn't know what was going on there. But fine, I went. We show up, the guy takes us into his house. The meeting takes place in his bedroom. Literally, this is where the meeting was going to take place. Literally, this is what happened. We're sitting there, this is how he runs his business. And I'm thinking to myself, if I wasn't here, what would this look like? So I know, my wife wouldn't walk into the house, let the door get closed and all that, that's true. But still, there are practical things that halacha says you have to be cautious. We have an example. A girl walking in a field where there's no one around, and she knows that if someone grabs her, there's no one that's going to be able to help her. So she's putting herself in a situation where anything could happen.
So and then let's say that she does, and nothing happens. What are the halakhic implications for that she gets now, then what happens if she
did something improper? Look, it's like there are a lot of things you can do improper and nothing happens. You could go parachuting and you don't have a safety net. And it's improper and nothing happens.
In terms of the halakhic consequences,
this is something that's between her and her creator. She should know that that's not what she should have done, and she shouldn't do it in the future, and she should make amends for what she did between her and her creator. It's her own issue. It's not our issue. Look, let's take an example. A guard is on guard duty. He goes to sleep. When he goes to sleep, no one attacks. Nothing happens. Did he do something wrong? Does he have to pay someone? No one knows about it. It's between him and his creator. He did something wrong. He opened the potential for something bad to happen. And none of their business between her and her creator. But you know what? Why don't you digest what we said? Think about it. Okay. So
who's responding? It's called
discipline.
No, you're assuming that after something happened, we're blaming her. That's not true. The thing is, a division of responsibility. I have a responsibility to be a good human being. I have a responsibility to ensure I'll be a good human being. She has a certain part of the responsibility also. It's true, right? A girl is not supposed to be. It's an element of the modesty that we expect from her is not to put herself in that situation.
It's an element of modesty. That's one thing. But if it's an element of you, I actually would take it. I 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 would take it.
It's not a question of punishment. If a woman, it's question of what deem if there is a division of responsibility. Part of her responsibility, part of the elements of modesty we accept, we do expect from a woman, is not to put herself in that situation for her own sake. Is he going to be right if he did it? No, we'll kill him if he does it. But that still doesn't mean we encourage her services. They don't do it. But by the same token, I say don't send your boys to go to swim alone either. It's a question of being practical. Things can happen. No. Okay, so then, I don't see what's bothering you that we say you have to be practical in a world that wants to endanger you. That's the world we live in. You'll say, I'll walk into Harlem without anything. Why do you blame me? I didn't do anything foolish. You did do something foolish in walking to Harlem.
But if the government says, you know, they're not allowed to walk into Harlem without a garment, you know,
The halacha does say that. Yeah, the halacha says we're responsible for you halachically, and the halacha will tell you may not walk into Harlem without a guard or without whatever is considered necessary precaution. It's true, in halacha we go beyond the government. We say part of the halacha is to tell you how to live a safe life, a good life, and part of what halacha does is tell you you cannot walk into Harlem. That's true, the halacha says that also. A person, just like you learned, cannot leave his rooftop unattended where people could fall and get hurt. A person's not allowed to put himself in a situation where there's a good chance that he's going to be harmed. Right? Allah will tell you that also. That's Allah. What can you do? Yeah.
I think, one thing,
before we continue on this point, I want to take a vote. How many guys want to continue on this point? Because if not, let's leave it for next Thursday night. On Thursday night, you guys debate anything you want.
One second,
how many people want to continue on this point? And how many people don't? Okay, sorry. So let's continue. You gotta go to the majority. It's not me.
Do it again.
How many people want to continue on this point? And how many people want to leave this point and go on to something else?
Oh,
it's still a majority. One more time. How many people want to stay on this topic? Okay.
All right.
The Torah tells us that there are certain people that are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. Now, this has nothing to do with our logic. Yeah. This is what guys voted not to do. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it on Thursday. You can raise any issue you want. Next time I have a Thursday night session. So, the halacha that tells who may marry into the Jewish people and who may not. And this has nothing to do with our logic. The Torah says this is the way it is, and for whatever reason, this is the way it is. There are certain blemishes that a person cannot have kids. If he has a tzuat daka, he has the male organ is cut, or the gonads are smashed, or a person is a mamzer. His father married a woman who was married, and this unfortunately happens every day. Women get married, and then the couple decides they want to break up, and if they're not very religious, so they don't bother getting a kosher get. Then halachically, they are still married. And then she goes and marries someone else, and has children. Now those children are halachically mamzerim. They may not marry the average Jew. So the Torah says that Hashem says, it says in Kohelet, Dimata Ashukim, God says, the tears of the people that were treated unjustly, who is that? So the Gemara says, those are the mamzerim. What did this poor kid do? He did nothing wrong. From what his parents did, he's now stuck for life. He's a mamzer. Unless he does there are ways of getting out of it. If he marries a female slave, his children can become kosher Jews. So that's why a mamzer, what he should do is look for a girl who's in the gear process, and then he can tell her, don't do gear yet. If they date, and it works out well, so he tells her, don't do gear. Sell yourself to me as my slave. then we'll marry. And halachically, now this has been done. This is halachically drafted. That this helps for mamzer, that is, those things aren't mamzer. Now, what? Yeah. No, that the kids are Jewish. They need the kids are Jewish, but they will undergo Giyur. They're going to be Kaver.
And that way they won't be Mamzer.
But they won't be Mamzer. Now, the kids are her kids. She's going to be a non-Jewish female slave. And the kids
are not born Jewish.
If I'm not mistaken, they're not born Jewish. Correct.
She knows the word.
Once she converts, then she's a Giyorist, and we didn't solve the problem. The whole reason why we solve the problem is because she is a female slave who accepts mitzvahs like a female and immerses as for the sake of being a female slave. Now she keeps mitzvahs like a female slave. She's not a Jew. She's one level down from Jew. She's not a non-Jew. She's not a Jew. She's in between.
Can she upgrade?
What?
Can she upgrade
after the marriage? No, if she, with the second she upgrades, she becomes a Jew. Anytime he's married to a Jew, then the children are going to be Mamzer. The whole point is that the Jews, the ordinarily, right, once you can't have kids, so she'll upgrade. But,
what if they're married and then she converts?
Once she becomes Jewish, so they could continue, he's allowed to marry, but, if I'm not mistaken. Now, we have a minute when we do a bris for a child, so we bless the child. We say, God, kayem et yel dazel aviv leimo, may you sustain this child, may he be successful. His parents have nachas from him. When the child's a mamzer, we don't say that. We keep quiet. We don't say anything because we don't want to keep him there in the world. So, poor kid, he did nothing wrong. But we're not wishing him that he prosper and have many, many offspring. We don't say anything. There's also a minhag, there's a custom that if the child is a mamzer, we give him the name Kidor. Now, Kidor, it comes from the pasuk Kidor Tapuchos Hema. They are a generation of everything's upside down. Banim, their sons, lo imun bam, you can't have faith in them. This is like a secret way of hinting what the kid is. Now, the Gemara records that Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda were traveling together, and Rabbi Meir was very smart. He used to be able to tell from people's names what kind of people they were. And Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, they weren't careful. So they came to him in, and the owner of the inn, his name was Kidor. So Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, they told him, look, Shabbos is coming, hold our wallets for us. And Rabbi Meir, he went to the graveyard, and he went to the owner, this Kitor's father's grave, and he put his wallet by his head. So that evening, Friday night, Kitor comes to him and he says, hey Rabbi, I had a dream this afternoon, or last night, Shabbos morning. My father came to me in a dream and he told me, come get the money that's by my head. So Meir hears the dream, he tells Kidor, he tells him, no, you ate too much Friday afternoon, don't worry about it. When you eat a lot Friday afternoon, you have a fancy dream. Must be Shabbos, he runs to the grave, he digs out his wallet, and the next morning they want to leave, so Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi come to Kidor and they tell him, give us back our wallets. So Kidor says, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, what do you mean, give you our wallets before Shabbos? He says, no, I don't know anything about it. So they followed him, and they waited outside the yard. He comes out, and he goes to the inn, to the tavern. And they see that he has some lentils on his mustache. So when they see him sitting at the tavern, they come back to, they knock on the door, and they tell his wife, your husband said us, he said, give us the wallet, and he said that the sign that he sent us is that you two ate for lunch, you ate lentils. So she gave him the wallet. Kidor comes back home. He asks her, where are the wallets? So she said, I gave it to you. They gave me your son. He said, what son? I never talked to them. He killed her. She ended up dead. So our sages say that from this story that the importance of washing one's hands after the meal can sometimes cost the life. So if he would have washed his hands, this Kidor, after the meal, but now when people wash their hands, they also wash their husband, they wash their beard.
One of the others,
the other ones asked him, they said, why didn't you give him the wallet? So he said, I noticed his name was Kidor, and the pasuk says, Kidor Tafu Chos Hema. They're a nation that everything is upside down this generation. You can't trust them. So they said, why didn't he tell us? So he said, because when you see a name, you can think maybe it's a sign. You can't say conclusively. So I couldn't tell you conclusively there's a problem here. I for myself, was worried. I didn't want to say something bad about him when I don't know. So that's a mamzer. We have the custom, we name them Kidor. And this is the place in Gemara where the name Kidor shows up. Just saying, Shri, yeah? A mamzer is from a relationship that the Torah prohibits with the punishment of kares,
right,
which we call adultery, but it doesn't, it's every form of kares other than a nida. A husband, any woman when she's a nida is prohibited with karet, just like one's sister, one's mother. But if one has relations with a nida, we say that the offspring is a nida is a woman when she has her period before she immerses in the mikvah. Nida comes from the word to flow. When she has a menstrual flow, they are prohibited to be together, and the prohibition is kares. And then, if they are together before she goes to the mikvah, the child is not a mamzer. That is the one exception. Otherwise, we say every yosher kares, the child is a mamzer. With a goy, yeah. I'm trying to remember, you have to understand. Before I came to class today, I reviewed maybe 15 chapters of all these laws. And the people sitting next to me were all looking at me like a weirdo. Why are you reading about this all the time? This man, or that girl, this man, that girl, this man, that girl. I'm sitting there reading. I spent 2 hours reading it, and I don't remember all the details. What you're saying sounds right, but I don't remember now. It sounds right that the child might not be an amzeh. I don't, if it's a goy, right, could be. It sounds right, but I don't remember conclusively.
And it's not the same.
As far as that, I'm not sure. I don't remember at all. I don't even know the joke. I don't know. Yeah. Very complicated. I'll tell you one of the complications, but we can't go into it. I showed the guys who were buying me for Shabbos 2 weeks who have 3 volumes on this issue. On the in vitro fertilization, among other things, but a lot of it is on that. 15 years ago, when they started in vitro fertilization, 15, 20 years ago, they told the men, look, your sperm is going to be what's fertilizing the egg, but we're just adding carrier sperm to help it get to where it's supposed to get to. When in truth, it wasn't their sperm that was making the baby. So halacha, we researched it and we saw that they were lying to people. But it made people feel better. They said, look, there is a chance that this sperm will impregnate the egg, it will fertilize the egg, but we're only using it to help it get along. I mean, you're not impregnating your wife because you need this help. So they called it a carrier sperm. That's what they called it. But in truth, there wasn't what was going on. Aside from which, there are a lot of... Metaf, Machon Puat Puat Institute around the corner from Machon Meir, has a special task force in many hospitals around the world watching that in vitro fertilization because they mess up. And you'll be surprised. You think this small organization that's around the corner from the yeshiva, they have their task force. How many mistakes could they catch? A lot. So babies, you could watch. You know, it's your baby, they put a wristband on it. And constant in vitro fertilization, those are just 2 examples of things that are going on. Some that went on, some that are still going on today. So before any couple considers it, they have to consult with the rabbi. I can also tell you that, unfortunately, doctors are very quick to prescribe. There are many, many instances where, give the couple time. I know a couple that's married now 7-8 months, and they've already underwent, I don't know how many forms of treatment, but the joke between doctors is, if you want to be a successful fertility specialist, so treat couples after they're married only 2 months. Because usually it works out on its own, and you could always take the credit. So the best way to be successful is to treat them early, when you don't even know if there's a problem. That's a joke that doctors say. But there's a lot of anti-tanking going on. You have to know what you're doing. Yeah. As far as I know, they may, but they should consult their rabbi. These issues are dealt with in depth. The reason why you're asking is because they might have to remove one of his gonads, right? Right. So that's dealt with. I haven't yet learned the response on this matter, but as far as I know, these people are getting married, so they must have some leniency they're based on. I don't know, I haven't learned this issue, I don't know. But as far as I know, they're getting married. So there must be some leniency out there. I don't know what it is, but... I didn't say that. You should ask a rabbi, because today it seems like that there are leniencies that people can rely on. Everything is if it's man-made. One thing that does happen, surprise, sometimes people discover when they're like 30, 40, that they're down to one. That happens. Sometimes the gonad could disappear, just like melt away. And then they're permitted to remain. That's not a problem. That's natural. It could happen that one melts. I mean, there are many babies born that they doesn't come down. And sometimes. Don't worry. Okay. Let's begin. Okay. We're making good headway through the parsha, despite all the questions.